questions@ahaprocess.com, and we will pose those to Sue now when we get to our Q&A time. Amanda will just forward those to me, Sue now, and I'll shoot those to you. And that's questions with an S on it, so questions@ahaprocess.com. I know everybody's time is valuable and limited, so I'll get right to introducing our speaker today. Today we're going to have Dr. Sunel DeHart of Decatur, Texas, talk with us. She's been a professional educator since 1964, having served as a classroom teacher, teacher of the deaf, special education teacher, K-12 gifted and talented coordinator, curriculum consultant, assistant principal, elementary principal, central office administrator, and adjunct professor, and I think Superwoman should be in there somewhere as well. When she was principal, her school was considered a low socioeconomic campus, but it was repeatedly recognized for its innovative techniques, inclusion practices, and outstanding academic gains of at-risk students. Sunel has also taught at Texas Women's University in Denton, Texas, and currently serves as a consultant for AHA Process. If you want more information on what Sunel is talking about today, please just email or call us. Also, Sunel is available for consulting and workshops at your school. So, Sunel, please take it away.
Okay. Well, thank you. First of all, I want to welcome you also, and thanks, Stephanie, for your introduction to today's telecast. Now, Dr. Payne, you know, instead of calling her Dr. Payne, why don't we just refer to her as Ruby? Because she always says, how would you like to be known as Dr. Payne? So the information presented in Ruby's book, Under Resource Learners, 8 Strategies to Boost Student Achievement, is what we're talking about today. And that book really means a lot to me because, first of all, I lived it as a student growing up in poverty and then teaching and working in low socioeconomic schools myself. However, the other day, I was presenting from Dr. Payne's research-based strategies, narrowing the achievement gap for under-resourced students. That's what we at AHA call our day two. And I was presenting to a middle school, and a teacher raised her hand and said, I teach 8th grade English. Don't you think 8th grade is too late to start teaching these strategies? Shouldn't this have been done at the elementary level? Well, you know, I really did appreciate her comment, because don't you imagine there are a lot of other teachers out there that are thinking the same thing and just don't have the courage to express their opinion. So I said, you know, you're absolutely right. That would be the perfect scenario if there were long-term planning within a district and these strategies could be started at elementary where it's age appropriate and continued all the way through high school. By the time the students got to you, the strategies would be second nature to them. And your role would just be helping your students refine and utilize the strategies, taking them to an even higher level of effectiveness for themselves. However, you know, that's what's so exciting to me about this work. And it's part of the beauty of these strategies. They're based on under-resourced learners' learning needs. The purpose is to get these students on the educational playing field in a hurry. The strategies are not hard to present to students. There's no extra money required for material or special equipment. They fit into whatever content we're teaching, and they're quick and easy for students to assimilate. I like what Dr. Payne always says. They're down and dirty. And many of these have been developed by teachers like Kim Ellis, Bethany Tucker, Patty Albright, Shelley Rex, and many other master teachers with a magnitude of experience with under-resourced learners. And then, on top of all that, they're all strongly research-based. Now, isn't that something we as teachers all need and want for our students? Well, that's why I especially appreciate what Dr. Payne said on page 2 of Under-Resourced Learners. The good news is that resources can be developed at any stage in life. And Under-Resourced Learners, 8 Strategies to Boost Student Achievement, is about just how to do that. Now, this took me back to my own experience as a student. I didn't begin to become a good student until ninth grade. I was coming out of a geometry class after having failed the test for the day, and as I descended the stairs, a fellow student, Terry Westfall, was running and calling after me, "Hey, Sunil, wait up. What did you get on that test?" "I failed it," I said, and a big smile spread across his face as he said, "Oh, man, that's wonderful." Well, I was so angry with him that if I could have killed, he would have been dead right there on the school steps. "Why would you say something like that?" I yelled at him. But as he was running down the stairs, he turned and shouted back at me, "Because you're the smartest girl in class. If you failed it, then I don't feel so bad failing it too." My whole life stood still at that moment, right there on the high school stairs. No one in my entire life had ever said I was smart. Why was that? I wasn't. But it was right there on the steps that I decided I would become that good student he thought I was. Oh my word, I can't tell you how hard I worked trying to build my learning skills. Learning skills I didn't have, or I didn't even know where to find them. And in reality, I crashed and burned much more than I ever improved. I had no one to help me, coach me, or teach me the strategies that would have made it easier. You know, I would have given my IT to have learned as a ninth grader how to attack nonfiction reading, how to sort information from text, question making, planning backwards, which is kind of ironic. I did learn that while I was working on my dissertation. We had to make a PERT chart, planning backwards from when the dissertation was printed to the beginning where we wrote survey questions. So it really is never too late to develop our resources. In fact, AHA has a book that just came out in 2009 called Understanding and Engaging Under-Resourced College Students by Becker, Cradell, Tucker. And they modify some of these very strategies to help college and adult under-resourced learners. The book establishes a post-secondary platform for the strategies that are contained in A Framework for Understanding Poverty by Dr. Payne, Bridges Out of Poverty by Ruby Payne, Philip DeVoe, and Terry Smith, and Getting Ahead in a Just Getting By World by Philip DeVoe. So again, that's why Ruby's work on resources is always so meaningful to me. It really is applicable for students across the spectrum. And aren't we also running into students every day who come from middle class and affluent homes who are missing some of these same resources? She's quick to point out, and I'll bring it to our attention, that when working with children, little children, we look at the resources of the household. Now, we have a video clip in AHA that we often show during our presentation of a home situation that is not child-centered. It's survival-centered. And in the clip, it's late at night, the mother comes in from her job, she locks the door and is so exhausted that she can't even get past the couch. She flops down right there, and her older daughter is trying to study, asks if she can fix her something to eat. Well, her mother waves her away. She's even too tired to eat. And then she says, "Mija, can you turn off that light?" Now, is this mother going to be able to read 20 minutes an evening with four or five little children in her home? I wonder how many 20 minutes that would take. Does it mean the mother's lazy? Does it mean she doesn't care? Does it mean she doesn't love her children? In fact, when she asked her daughter to turn off the light, she addressed her with a term of endearment, "Mija." No, it's just not a child-centered home. It's a survival-centered home. You know, is reading 20 minutes an evening really all that important? Absolutely. The research is strong on its benefits. However, when we look at a household like this, we see we're going to have to think outside the box on how to get 20 minutes of reading in and how it's realistically accomplished. When working with adolescents and adults, instead of focusing on the household resources, Ruby says we should look at the individual and the larger support system to which this individual has access. And I honestly believe that one of the quickest and easiest ways for you and me to be a support system for these under-resourced students is teaching them the strategies within our own content that would help them navigate their everyday situation. Well, for today and the purpose of her book, Under-Resourced Learners, that takes on the United Nations meaning. And it is said to be a way to talk about students who don't have access to a number of resources that are necessary for school success. Not having the resources to address a particular situation or negotiate a particular environment. In this book, Dr. Payne very thoughtfully addresses and gives practical solutions and suggestions for application for the 8 strategies of assessing resources of individual students to determine interventions, 2, building relationships of mutual respect with students, teaching formal register and story structure, 4, teaching tools for negotiating the abstract representational world, 5, teaching appropriate behaviors and procedures, 6, using the 6-step process to keep track of every student's learning, and 7, building relationships of mutual respect with parents, 8, developing community collaboration models to address under-resourced situations. Aren't those the very strategies that everyone is always asking for? So probably the most frequently asked question by teachers is this: how do I get my students to want to learn? Well, Chapter 2, Building Mutual Respect, addresses that very aspect. It's replete with example after example of how to practically begin to develop this kind of a safe environment within the classroom and the school. Now, Dr. Frank Comer of Yale University, who's one of my heroes, says, "No significant learning occurs without a significant relationship of mutual respect." Sometimes I think as teachers, we're so pressured for achievement that we think and we say, you know, I don't have time to put one more thing on my plate. And you know, we don't. However, sometimes I think we forget that relationship is the place. A lot of misbehavior could be redirected when the classroom is set up for success. Wouldn't you agree? And on Chapter 5, on teaching appropriate behaviors and procedures, that's a whole goldmine of information. There's a whole section in there on setting up classroom procedures to give positive structure to the time we work with students. Ruby also has a little book called Discipline Strategies of the 21st Century Classroom, Working with Students, where she even asks master teachers to provide this very checklist on how they set up their classrooms for the year. There are examples from K, lower and upper middle, elementary, middle school, high school. So you and I know how important it is, as schools are required to address accountability, that it becomes necessary for us to keep track of learning of each individual student. And that's a real paradigm shift, isn't it? But it can be done very effectively, and again, practically and personally. Chapter 6, using the 6-step process to keep track of every student's learning, is presented for us. And you know, I use this in my school and it made such a difference that it was then required by the entire district. In fact, we were at a district principal's meeting, and the assistant superintendent said, Sunel had three students this year that did not show mastery on the state assessment. But what is really remarkable is I bet she can tell you by name who they were, by how many points they missed it, and probably any other information needed. So I've asked her today to teach us Dr. Payne's six-step process for keeping track of every student's learning. You know, I did. We worked on it. And we were all amazed at how simple, time-efficient, and really effective it was. Now, Chapter 7 is on working with parents, and that's one of my favorites, because when I was a principal, I really worked hard in this area. I was so proud of how our school's parents stepped up to the plate and really became partners in their educational process for their children. They said they felt respected, they felt important, they felt welcome, and so they contributed to their children's development. Sometimes, though, you know, as a school, we're not resourced enough to help all our students. So what then? Well, Chapter 8 presents several projects that bring phenomenal success to our school community. Today, in this hour, you know, we don't really have time to go into each of these eight strategies in depth as she does in the book. So I'd like to look, if you don't mind, at Strategy 4, Teaching Formal Register and Story Structure. That's Chapter 3 in the book. And I'd also like to look a little at Number 1, Assessing Resources. You know, people have repeatedly asked me how I was able to get out of policy. And, you know, I've wondered that myself because I had so few of the resources necessary to break out of my situation. But I did have one jewel, formal register. Now, not in the beginning, of course. You know, it kind of reminds me of George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion, when Eliza Doolittle goes to Professor Higgins and offers to pay him to teach her to talk more genteel, like formal register, so she could work in a flower shop instead of on the street. Well, my Professor Higgins was a speech teacher by the name of Opal Wright, and I mean to tell you, she was as tough as Henry Higgins, too. She gave me extra vocabulary work. Each week, she tore out the word power section from Reader's Digest. Remember that? And had me learn those words. And I had to use each one of them at least 5 times in a sentence a week. And then I was to keep record of them in a notebook, sort of my own customized dictionary. And if I were able to combine some of those words correctly, of course, I got extra credit. Now think about the words you find in Reader's Digest, the word power section. Lanyap, photosynthesis, really, I mean, you can read a million words before you run across words like that again. But Mrs. Wright had me look at and analyze the word parts of those words so that when I ran across other words that contained those parts, I could begin to figure them out. Well, we have a recent publication in AHA called The Integrated Approach to Student Achievement by Daniel Dickey. Have you seen that? Well, part of Dr. Dickey's approach to improving student performance was to see if they were exposed to word parts. Now, not in just one literary unit a year, but across content on a consistent basis. It was amazing how quickly students were able to multiply their vocabulary by tenfold. Now, my speech teacher, Mrs. Wright, insisted that I take 2 years of Latin in high school to build my vocabulary. She wouldn't let me end sentences with prepositions, like, where is he going to? Or where did he put it at? I was to say, where is he going? Where did he put it? And no between you and I, pronouns at the end of prepositional phrases, she said. Take the objective case. So between you and I becomes between you and me. And absolutely no double negatives. Words such as theater is pronounced theater. Doctorial, there was no I in it, she'd say. It's doctoral. And when I said, oh, look, I have a new felon in my tooth. You know, I'm sure that grated on her nerve like fingernails scratching down a chalkboard. She would say, you get felons in your teeth. A felon is someone who has committed a serious crime and should be given serious punishment. She also made me lower my voice. She said, I sound like a little girl, and that might be cute now, but when I was 30, it would be obnoxious, and no one would take me seriously. Well, she worked so hard with me that when I got a scholarship to Smith College in Massachusetts to learn to teach deaf children to talk, I had a professor there who was tough, too, and she thought it was a sin to teach deaf children colloquial speech patterns because she said it garbled their speech and made it hard to understand them. She prided herself, she had this hobby of being able to tell where you were from by listening to you say a phrase or two. I was the only student she had that she could not figure out where I was from. She said my speech was unnaturally clear, but I did tend to have a nasal in, so I must be from somewhere in the middle part of the country. Well, of course, over the years, my speech has deteriorated and taken on the dialect of the prominent culture here in Texas. But at least I'm not teaching deaf children and contaminating their speech. But really and truly, probably more than anything else, this entry into formal register made the biggest impact on my being able to make the transition from poverty to middle class. The language resource allowed me to share understanding, experiences, and information with others. And Ruby's right, learning did indeed become easier. I love what she said. The gift of language is unparalleled. It's a gift of thinking itself. And that's what I want to give students. And wouldn't you agree when Dr. Payne's talking about language, she's not talking just about language arts, but the language of the discipline or the content in which we're working. So let's review the language resources as presented in Chapter 3 for a few minutes. As you remember, the Dutch linguist Youth came up with the five registers of language. And it doesn't matter what language we speak, the registers remain the same. So if you have your book and you want to follow along, they're listed on page 40. But while you're finding that, let's look at the graph on the middle in the middle of page 41 at Hart and Reasley's research. Now, this is a long-term study. It was over 25 years. They went into homes to see how much language was going on for children between the ages of 1 to 4. And in the welfare home, the little ones were exposed to, now not learned, they were exposed to 13 million words. Now, if you look at your graph, this has been updated, so you may want to make that notation there. And in the working class home, they were exposed to 26 million. But look at your home. In the professional home, your little babies are exposed to 45 million words by the time they're 4 years old. That's what I always say. In poverty, we don't talk to our kids. We say things like, stop, quit, don't, whack. But in your home, you talk your kids to death. Look at lunch. In our poverty home, we just hand them something to eat and say, and go on about our business. But not you. No, sir. You say things like, what do you want for lunch? Do you want macaroni and cheese? How about a hot dog? Soup? Sandwich? Oh, you want a hot dog? What do you want on it? Mustard? Ketchup? Do you want some relish and cheese? What do you want to drink? We have milk. We have white or chocolate. You want Sprite or Dr. How about regular or diet? Yeah, how about tips? Do you want, and it goes on and on. Because this was a 25-year study, they were also able to estimate that an adult in a welfare home probably has a smaller vocabulary than a 3-year-old in your home. Hart and Risley also reported that in a welfare home, the youngster gets an average of 2 corrections, a put-down, to every 1 affirmation. In another video that we have, we use the presentation that really shows this, is where a mother is saying that she appreciates it that her son cleans up around the house while she's at work. But she doesn't like it when he puts things where she can't find it. See, she gives him a compliment, but she doesn't keep it clean. She says, but. In a working class home, usually an average of 2 affirmations are given for every correction. But look at your professional household. 6 affirmations for each correction. Let's say we have a 3-year-old walking across the carpet with grape juice. And we say, oh, you know better than that. Oh, you're so smart. See, we really get into those affirmations. Because in middle class, we really believe it's important that our children have a good, strong, positive self-concept. And again, since this was a long-term study, Hart and Risley were able to estimate that by the time our poverty students are seniors in high school, they have probably received over 250,000 put-downs. In fact, I'd wager that if we ask a middle school classroom to tell us something that we as adults don't know about them or that we need to know about students their age, they tell us. The older they get, the more adults don't like them. So that kind of puts into perspective why these affirmations are so important, doesn't it? Okay, let's go ahead and look at the registers on page 40. Number 1, he called frozen. Now, this is a language that never changes, like the Lord's Prayer. I'm going to mark out wedding vows here. That's a joke today, isn't it? And the next one is formal. Now, I usually draw a box around that. This is the language of school and work. When we're teaching in the classroom, we use formal registers, right? And when we're in the workplace, a formal workplace, we communicate in formal register. It has a standard syntax. We don't say things like, he ain't got no. We say he doesn't have any. There are abstractions and questions make up a big part of the formal register. It has a working vocabulary of about 1,600 words. Now, I have to tell you that when I first heard Dr. Payne say that, I thought she was mistaken. You know, 1,600 doesn't seem like a lot to me. And I was going to ask her about it, but she was busy, so I just figured it out myself. That's the men's vocabulary. Isn't that right? At the end of the day, we say, how was your day? And what do they say? Fine. And see, they don't talk the rest of the evening because they've used up all their words for the day. Now, women, we have a much bigger vocabulary. Wouldn't you agree? Or else we tend to say the same thing over and over again. I think the men call that nagging. Now, the third one he calls consulting. And this is the register between formal and casual. And I think the best way Dr. Payne explains that is when she shares that when Winston Churchill went to write his memoirs, he couldn't spell. So he just dictated them to his secretary. And so she typed them up, just like he said it. They say he's very easy to read, and it sounds like he's talking to you. Consulting. Now, the fourth register is casual, and I usually draw a box around that one, too. This is a language between friends. It's also the language of poverty. It has a working vocabulary of about 400 to 800 words. Mercy. No wonder it's so hard for students to learn. No wonder it's so hard for them to write with such a limited vocabulary. It kind of reminds me of a story Kim Ellis tells about going into a class of 14-year-olds. And after giving directions, the teacher asked the students if they understood. Well, they all shook their heads like bobbleheads. So she instructed them to get started. Well, a bunch of hands went up, and she said, "I thought you said you understood." And they shook their heads again and said, "Oh, yes, they understood." Well, the teacher told them to draw a picture in the margin of their paper to show what understood looked like to them. Only two students in the entire class got it right. One student drew a circle to represent a head with a light bulb over it. The other student drew a circle to represent a head and then drew arrows coming into the head. The rest of the class drew ears, E-A-R-S. So what did understood mean to them? Did you hear me? Now just think of all the formal register words we use every day, all day long in class, that many of our students have no idea what we're talking about. This casual register also has very little abstraction. A lot of word assists and gestures are used, and there's very little questioning. Now, we say, you know, kids are always asking questions, but if we really listen, what we hear is they're making statements with inflections at the end. A student will say, "Teacher, lunch?" See, that's not a question. That's two words with inflections at the end of each. We'll give out directions, and we'll say, "Are there any questions?" And these hands will go up, and we'll say, "Now, what's your question?" And a student will reply, "All of them." See, that's not a question. That's a phrase with an inflection at the end. What is the question? Do we have to do all of the problems? See, research indicates that if we cannot formulate a question syntactically in our head, then we can't get in there and know what we know or don't know. Now, the fifth register he called intimate. This is a language between lovers and or twins. And oftentimes, this one is sexual in nature. Youth also said you could go up a register or down a register in the same conversation, and it's socially accepted. Oh, but to drop a register or two is seen offensive to the group we're in. So let's say we're in the social studies or history class, and we're discussing the Civil War. We're in formal register, and somebody quotes something from the Gettysburg Address, moving up to frozen. That would be seen as acceptable. So let's say the teacher asked the student why he didn't read the Gettysburg Address as his homework assignment. And the student says, "Because it's stuck." Well, we've dropped a couple of registers, wouldn't you say? We've dropped down to casual. Also, let's say we're in a classroom teaching using formal register, and then we get on to a student for his behavior. And pretty soon, he's had enough. So under his breath, he says, "F you." Well, now he's dropped all the way to the bottom. And why would he do this? You know he knows better. What's he after? Sure, he's after a reaction. Now, he's not after attention here. He's angry, and he wants a reaction. And sometimes don't we give him the best reaction he could ever ask for? The top of our head flies off, steam's coming out of our ears, our head is spinning around, and we're yelling at the top of our lungs, "You're out of here. You cannot talk to me like that." Well, I wonder what would happen if we said in an adult voice instead, "You know, that's intimate register. You need to give me two translations of that in formal." Now, of course, that does not mean that we're encouraging teachers to teach intimate register in the classroom. However, Dr. Payne does believe we should teach them the registers and to translate between them. Now, can't you, with younger children, she says we should teach the formal and the casual. Those are the two I draw the box around. And she suggests that we draw a picture of a television and say something to the effect, formal register is the language newscasters use on TV, and that's the language we use in our classroom. Then we draw a picture of friends and say, casual, this is the language we use with our friends and at home. To older children, she believes, as students, she believes we should teach all of the registers. And if we look on page 42 and 43, she's given us some examples of translations between casual and formal register for secondary students. And I just adore that translation of my bad. It translates in formal register to, it was my fault. Please excuse me. Well, how about this one? I accept responsibility for my grievous error. Now, can you imagine teenagers talking like that? Of course not. But, Dr. Payne says, if you cannot speak formal register in the first 3 minutes of a job interview, well then, you probably ain't gonna get no job. However, it would be just as silly if someone were, if you and I were in a dangerous situation on the street and a man were walking towards us with a gun, and we were to say in perfect formal register, excuse me, sir, do I detect a firearm in your appendage? I love it when Dr. Payne says sometimes students will tell you that formal register is white or it's uppity. And she replies that formal register is the language of money. You have to speak it if you want to earn money in a legitimate manner. So it's so important that students can use both casual and formal register. And having students translate from formal to casual or vice versa can be a really fun and a great whole group experience. Even at elementary, can't you just see elementary students falling out on the floor when we ask them to translate, he cutted the formal register? Or what about, teacher, he farted? We could say, well, yeah, that's casual register, the way we talk to our friends. But how would you translate that to formal to report it to an adult? Maybe you could say, Miss Johnson, Billy is passing gas in the classroom again, and the smell is offensive to my olfactory nerves. Why, they'd just fall out the floor, wouldn't they? Well, you know, I was in Chicago talking to administrators, and a very attractive and distinguished black woman came in early. And she said to me, why would the district pay money to bring you in to talk about poverty when all they really need to do is ask me? Well, I said, you know, I don't know, but I certainly would appreciate your input and any help you could give me during my presentation. Well, she sat through the presentation and really had very little to contribute. But she stayed after everyone had left, and she said she wanted to tell me her story. She said as a third grader, she had gone to her white teacher and asked her if she could take speech therapy lessons because she didn't talk right. And the teacher said, there's nothing wrong with the way you pronounce words. You just speak the language of your neighborhood. And it's important that you do. Or how would you be able to talk to your family and friends? But if you want to learn another way to speak, the way we do here at school, if you can stay after school, I'll be glad to work with you. So the teacher got a teletrainer. Now, most of you are too young to know what those are. But they were phones, almost like walkie-talkies, that Bell Telephone loaned out to schools so students could practice their telephone skills. So after school, they would talk on the phone to each other. And the teacher would say, now, let's say I'm the president and I'm calling you. So now, how would you talk to him? or then she would say, I'm your auntie, and I've called to talk to you and invite you over. So how would you talk to her? And so forth. Well, later on, the lady became a teacher and a principal of a large alternative school in Chicago. And she said that when she talked to students and their parents, she often used casual register. But when she went downtown to administration to ask for money for the school, she very definitely switched to formal. She said she was selected as Administrator of the Year. And when she went to the banquet to receive her honor, she took the little old teacher with her to share in the celebration. She said if it hadn't been for this teacher giving her the gift of formal register and still respecting the language she needed in her neighborhood, she really didn't believe she would have ever accomplished what she did. So, language strategy, how we structure it and the words we use determine our ability to communicate beyond ourselves with a wider audience, doesn't it? Vocabulary can limit or enhance both our experiences and the development of social capital as much as any other factor. The gift of language is unparalleled. It's the gift of thinking itself. Well, I hope today's telecast has kindled your interest in this publication of Understanding the Under-Resourced Learner and made you want to look at other strategies presented in Dr. Payne's book. Or at least, I hope it reminds you and me of the educational resources that are available to us through AHA. If you contact the AHA office and share with them your specific needs, they can provide you with a consultant that can come to your district, your business, or even your church and do staff development according to your particular needs. If you're interested in a district-wide long-term commitment, the office can put you in touch with Dr. Donna McGee, who's Vice President in charge of research and development. If you work with adults outside the schoolhouse, or you want to get in there and have a program for parents that is beyond compare, the office can put you in touch with Philip DeBowles and his Getting Ahead in the Just Getting By world. I am so impressed with this program because the parents or adults decide for themselves what class they're living in and if they want out or not. If they learn the hidden rules of middle class, because even if you don't want out of poverty, you're probably going to work for someone in middle class. But if they do want to change their class, they develop their own plan on how they're going to do that. Kind of reminds you of, we can keep feeding them, or we can teach them to fish so they can feed themselves. Also, it tends to affect two generations at once. The parents, and then the parents affecting their children. Also, as you know, there are any number of publications on working with under-resourced learners at AHA that would make outstanding book studies within your organization. And new publications are coming out all the time. So today, thank you so much for your time and your commitment and dedication to your clientele. So, Stephanie, that's all I have.
I don't have any. Well, wonderful, and thank you so much, Sunil. You're just packed with information. And I don't have any questions right now. You seem to have covered so many bases. If a question pops up in your head, over the next hour or so, go ahead and email us at questions@ahaprocess.com, and I'll forward those to Sunil so we can get an answer for you. If you've got any questions about the Under-Resourced Learner book, that's on our website, or you can, of course, always call our office at 800-424-9484, and we'll be happy to help you with anything. And we hope that you've enjoyed the teleseminar, and hope that you will join us for next month, which is by Bethany Tucker.
That'll be great.
So, more information. Let's see. I thought that one of the emails came through and we had a question, but nope, not yet.
Now, what are we going to be talking about?
Bethany is going to be talking about how to motivate your students.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, so that should be wonderful. Again, Bethany is always full of full of information and great ideas, so hopefully you'll all be able to join us then. And we'll be getting an e-blast out to everyone who's on this list. And, of course, if you've got anyone who would like to be added to that list, again, just call or email us, and we'll be happy to notify you of all the teleseminars. So, Sunil, thank you so much for being with us today and for pouring out all of this great information. And I look forward to being together again soon.
Well, thank you.
Thanks so much. Okay, take care. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.